When he was gone, Abelly smiled. Zama has asked us not to leave. It would be difficult to do so. Have you seen the guards that have been placed at every entrance? Yes, they are not easy to overlook. Hal stood up from the carved ebony stool and crossed to the low doorway of the hut. He counted 20 men at the gate. They were all magnificent warriors, tall and well-muscled, and each was armed with spear and war axe. They carried tall shields of dappled black and white oxhide, and their headdresses were of crane's feathers. "It will be more difficult to leave this place than it was to enter," Abelly said grimly. At sunset there came another procession of young girls bearing the evening meal. "I can see why your royal brother carries such a goodly cargo of fat," Hal remarked, as he surveyed the superabundance of food. Once they declared their hunger satisfied, the girls retired with the platters and pots, and Zama came back. This time he led two maidens, one by each hand. The girls knelt before Hal and Abelly. Hal recognized the prettiest and pertest of the two as the girl who had been the live throne of the Monomotapa.
"The Monomotapa sends these females to you to sweeten your dreams with the honey of their loins," said Zama, and retired.
In consternation, Hal watched the pretty one raise her head and smile at him shyly. She had a calm, sweet face with full lips and huge dark eyes. Her hair had been twisted and braided with beads, so that the tresses hung to her shoulders. Her body was plump and glossy. Her breasts and buttocks were naked. Only now she wore a tiny beaded apron in front.
"I see you, great lord," she whispered, "and my eyes are dimmed by the splendour of your presence."
She crept forward like a kitten and laid her head upon his lap. "You cannot stay here," Hal sprang to his feet. "You must go away at once." The girl stared up at him in dismay, and tears filled her dark eyes.
"Do I not please you, great one?" she murmured.
"You are very pretty," Hal blurted. But how could he tell her that he was married to a golden memory?
"Let me stay with you, lord," the girl pleaded pathetically. "If you reject me, I will be sent to the executioner. I will die with the sharp stake thrust up through the secret opening of my body to pierce my bowels. Please let me live, O great one. Have mercy on this unworthy female, O glorious white face."
Hal turned to Abelly.
"What can I do?"
"Send her away," Abelly shrugged. "As she says, she is worthless. You can stop up your ears so that you do not have to listen to her screaming on the stake. Do not mock me, Abelly. You know I cannot betray the memory of the woman I love. Sukina is dead, Gundwani. I also loved her as a brother, but she is dead. This child is alive, but she will not be so by sunset tomorrow unless you take pity upon her. Your vow was not anything that Sukina demanded of you." Abelly stooped over the other girl, took her head, and lifted her to her feet. "I cannot give you any further help, Gundwani. You are a man, and Sukina knew that. Now that she has gone, she might deem it fitting that you live the rest of your life like one." He led his own girl to the rear of the hut, where a pile of soft karosses was laid and a pair of carved wooden headrests stood side by side. He laid her down and dropped the leather curtain that screened them. "What is your name?" Hal asked the girl who crouched at his feet.
"My name is Inyosi, Honeybee," she answered. "Please do not send me to die."
She crawled to him, clasped his legs, and pressed her face to his lower body.
I cannot," he mumbled. I belong to another."
But he wore only the beaded loincloth, and her breath was warm and soft on his belly, and her hand stroked the backs of his legs.
"I cannot," he repeated desperately.
But one of Inyosi's little hands crept up under his loincloth.
"Your mouth tells me one thing, mighty lord," he purred, "but the great spear of your manhood tells me another."
Hal let out a smothered groan.
picked her up in his arms and ran with her across the floor to where his own pallet of furs had been laid out. At first, Inyosi was startled by the fury of his passion, but then she let out a joyous cry and matched him kiss for kiss and thrust for thrust. In the dawn, as she prepared to leave him, she whispered, "You have saved my worthless life. In return, I must attempt to save your illustrious one." She kissed him one last time, then murmured with her lips against his head, "I heard the Monomotapa speak to Zama while he bestrode my back. He believes that Abuli has returned to claim the seat of heaven from him. Tomorrow, during the audience to which he has commanded you and Abuli, he will give the order for his bodyguard to seize you and hurl you from the clifftop onto the rocks below, where the hyenas and the vultures wait to devour your corpses." Inyosi snuggled against his chest. "I do not want you to die, my lord. You are too beautiful."
Then she rose from the pallet and slipped away silently into the darkness. Hal crossed to the hearth and threw a faggot of firewood upon it. The smoke rose up through a hole in the centre of the domed roof, and the flames lit the interior with flickering yellow light.
"Abuli, are you alone? We must talk at once," he called,
and Abuli came out from behind the curtain.
"The girl is asleep, but speak in English."
"Your brother intends to have both of us killed during the audience."
"The girl told you this?" Abuli asked,
and Hal nodded guiltily at the mention of his infidelity. Abuli smiled in sympathy.
"So the little honeybee saves your life, huh? Sukino would rejoice for that. You need feel no guilt."
"If we attempt to escape, your brother would send an army to pursue us. We would never reach the river again."
"So, do you have a plan, Gundwani?"
Zama came to lead them to the royal audience. They stepped out of the gloom of the great hut into the brilliant African sunlight, and Hal paused to gaze around the concourse of the Monomotapa. He could only estimate their numbers, but a full regiment of the royal bodyguard ringed the open space, perhaps 1,000 tall warriors with the high headdresses of crane's feathers turning each into a giant. The light morning breeze tossed and tumbled the feathers, and the sunlight glinted on their broad-bladed spears. Beyond them, the nobles of the tribe filled every space and lined the top of the wall of granite blocks that surrounded the citadel. 100 royal wives clustered about the door to the king's hut. Some were so fat and loaded with bangles and ornaments that they could not walk unaided and leant heavily on their handmaidens. When they waddled along, their buttocks rolled and undulated like soft bladders filled with lard. Zama led Hal and Abuli to the centre of the courtyard and left them there. A heavy silence fell on the throng, and no one moved, until suddenly the captain of the bodyguard blew a blast on a spiral kudu horn, and the Monomotapa loomed in the doorway of his hut. A moaning sigh swept through the gathering, and as one they threw themselves full length to the earth and covered their faces. Only Hal and Abuli remained standing upright. The Monomotapa strode to his living throne and sat upon Inyosi's naked back.
"Speak first," Hal breathed from the side of his mouth. "Don't let him give the order for our execution."
"I see you, my brother,"
Abuli greeted him, and the courtiers moaned with horror at this breach of protocol.
"I see you, great lord of the heavens."
The Monomotapa showed no sign of having heard.
"I bring you greetings from the ghost of our father Holomima, who was the Monomotapa before you."
Abuli's brother recoiled visibly, as though a cobra had reared up before his face.
"You speak with ghosts?" His voice trembled slightly. "Our father came to me in the night. He was as tall as a great baobab tree, and his face was terrible, with eyes of fire. His voice was as the thunder of the heavens. He came to me to issue a dire warning."
The congregation moaned with superstitious dread.
"What was this warning?"
croaked the Monomotapa, staring at his brother with awe.
Our father fears for our lives, yours and mine. Great danger threatens us both.
Some of the fat wives screamed, and one fell to the ground in a fit, frothing at the mouth.
What danger is this, Aboli?
The king glanced around him fearfully, as if seeking an assassin amongst his courtiers.
Our father warned me that you and I are joined in life as we were in birth. If one of us prospers, then so does the other.
The Monomotapa nodded.
What else did our father say?
He said that as we are joined in life, so we will be joined in death. He prophesied that we will die upon the very same day, but that that day is of our own choosing.
The king's face turned a strange greyish tone and glistened with sweat. The elders shrieked, and those nearest to where he sat drew small iron knives and slashed their own chests and arms, sprinkling their blood on the earth to protect him from witchcraft.
I am deeply troubled by these words that our father uttered, Aboli went on. I wish that I were able to abide with you here in the land of heaven, to protect you from this fate. But alas, my father's shade warned me further, that should I stay here another day, then I will die, and the Monomotapa with me. I must leave at once and never return. That is the only way in which we can both survive the curse.
So, let it be!
The Monomotapa rose to his feet and pointed with a trembling finger.
This very day you must be gone.
Alas, my beloved brother, I cannot leave here without that boon I came to speak from you. Speak, Aboli, what is it that you lack?
I must have 150 of your finest warriors to protect me, for a dreadful enemy lies in wait for me. Without these soldiers, then I go to Saturn death, and my death must portend the death of the Monomotapa.
Choose, bellowed the Monomotapa. Choose of my finest armadoda, and take them with you. They are your slaves. Do with them as you wish. But then get you gone this very day, before the setting of the sun. Leave my land forever.
In the leading pinnace, Hal shot the bar and rowed out through the Musela mouth of the delta into the open sea. Big Daniel followed closely, and there lay the Golden Bough at her anchor on the 10-fathom shoal where they had left her. Ned Tyler stood the ship to quarters and ran out his guns when he saw them approaching. The pinnaces were so packed with men that they had only an inch or two of freeboard, riding so low in the water. From afar they resembled war canoes. The glinting spears and waving headdresses of the Amadoda strengthened this impression, and Ned gave the order to fire a warning shot across their bows. As the cannon boomed out, and a tall plume of spray erupted from the water, half a cable's length ahead of the leading boat, Hal stood up in the bows and waved the croix patée.
"Lord love us!" Ned gasped. "'Tis the captain we're shooting at!"
"I'll not be in a hurry to forget that greeting you gave me, Mr. Tyler," Hal told him sternly as he came in through the entry port. "I rate a 4-gun salute, not a single gun."
"Bless you, Captain, I had no idea. I thought you was a bunch of heathen savages, begging your pardon, sir."
"That we are, Mr. Tyler, that we are."
And Hal grinned at Ned's confusion as a horde of magnificent warriors swarmed onto the Golden Bough's deck.
"Think you'll be able to make seamen of them, Mr. Tyler?"
As soon as he had made his offing, Hal turned the bows into the north once more and sailed up the inland channel between Madagascar and the mainland. He was heading for Zanzibar, the centre of all trade on this coast. There he hoped to have further news of the progress of the Holy War on the Horn, and, if he were fortunate, to learn something of the movements of the Gull of Murray. This was a settling-in time for the Amadoda. Everything aboard the Golden Bough was strange to them. None had ever seen the sea. They had believed the pinnaces to be the largest canoes ever conceived by man, and were overawed by the size of the ship, the height of her masts, and the spread of her sails. Most were immediately smitten by seasickness, and it took many days for them to find their sea legs. Their bowels were in a turmoil induced by the diet of biscuit and pickled meat. They hungered for their pots of millet porridge and their gourds of blood and milk. They had never been confined in such a small space, and they pined for the wide savannah. They suffered from the cold, for even in this tropical sea the trade winds were cool and the warm Mozambique current many degrees below the temperature of the sun-scorched plains of the savannah. Hal ordered Alcuda, who was in charge of the ship's stores, to issue bolts of sail canvas to them, and Abily showed them how to stitch petticoats and tarpaulin jackets for themselves. They soon forgot these tribulations when Abily ordered a platoon of men to follow Jiri and Matizi and Kimati aloft to set and reef sail. 100 dizzy feet above the deck and the rushing sea, swinging on the great pendulum of the mainmast, for the first time in their lives, these warriors, who had each killed their lion, were overcome by terror. Abily climbed up to where they clung helplessly to the shrouds and mocked them. "Ha! Look at these pretty virgins! I thought at first there might be a man among them, but I see they should all squat when they piss." Then he stood upright on the swaying yard and laughed at them. He ran out to the end of it, and there performed a stamping, leaping war dance. One of the Amadodo could abide his mockery no longer. He loosed his death grip on the rigging, and shuffled out along the yard to where Abily stood with hands on hips. "One man amongst them," Abily laughed, and embraced him. During the next week, three of the Amadodo fell from the rigging while trying to emulate this feat. Two dropped into the sea. But before Hal could wear the ship round to go back to pick them up, the sharks had taken them. The third man struck the deck, and his was the most merciful end. After that there were no more casualties, and the Amadodo, each one accustomed since boyhood to climbing the highest trees for honey and birds' eggs, swiftly became adept topmastmen. When Hal ordered bundles of pikes to be brought up from the hold and issued to the Amadodo, they howled and danced with delight, for they were spearmen born. They delighted in the heavy shafted pikes with their deadly iron heads. Abily adapted their tactics and fighting formation to the golden bow's cramped deck spaces. He showed them how to form the classical Roman testudo, their shields overlapping and locked like scales of an armadillo. With this formation they could sweep the deck of an enemy ship irresistibly. Hal ordered them to set up a heavy mat of oakum under the forecastle to act as a butt. Once the Amadodo had learned the weight and balance of the heavy pikes, they could hurl them the length of the ship to bury the iron heads full length in the mat of coarse fibres. They plunged into these exercises with such gusto that two of their number were speared to death before Abily could impress upon them that these were mock battles and should not be fought to the death. Then it was time to introduce them to the English longbow. Their own bows were short and puny in comparison, and they looked askance at the 6-foot weapon, dubiously tried the massive draw weight, and shook their heads. Hal took the bow out of their hands and knocked an arrow. He looked up at the single black and white gull that floated high above the mainmast. "If I bring down one of those birds, will you eat it raw?" he asked, and they roared with laughter at the joke. "I will eat the feathers as well," shouted a big cocky one named Ingwe, the leopard. In a fluid motion, Hal drew and loosed. The arrow arced up, its flight curving across the wind, and they shouted with amazement as it pierced the gull's snowy bosom and the wide pinions folded. The bird tumbled down in a tangle of wings and webbed feet and struck the deck at Hal's feet. An Amadodo snatched it up, and the transfixed carcass was passed from hand to hand amid astonished jabbering. "Do not ruffle the feathers," Hal cautioned them. "You will spoil Ingwe's dinner for him." From that moment their love of the longbow was passionate, and within days they had developed 2 archers of the first water. When Hal towed an empty water keg at full cable's length behind the ship, the Amadodo shot at it, first individually, then in massed divisions like English archers. When the keg was heaved back on deck, it was bristling like a porcupine's back, and they retrieved 7 out of every 10 arrows that had been shot. In one area alone, the Amadordo showed no aptitude at serving the great bronze culverins. Despite all the threats and mockery that Abelly heaped upon them, he could not get them to approach one with anything less than superstitious awe. Each time a broadside boomed, they howled, "It is witchcraft! It is the thunder of the heavens!" Howell drew up a new watchbill, in which the battle stations of the crew were rearranged, to have the white seamen serving the batteries and the Amadorda handling the sails and making up the boarding party. A standing bank of high clouds 20 leagues ahead of their bows marked the island of Zanzibar. A fringe of coconut palms ringed the white beach of the bay, but the massive walls of the fortress were even whiter, dazzling as the ice slopes of a glacier in the sunlight. The citadel had been built a century before by the Portuguese, and until only a decade previously, it had assured that nation's domination of the trade routes of the entire eastern shores of the African continent. Later, the Omani Arabs, under their warrior king Ahmed El Grang, the left-handed, had sailed in with their war dhows, attacked the Portuguese, and had driven out their garrison with great slaughter. This loss had signalled the beginning of the decline of Portuguese influence on the coast, and the Omanis had usurped their place as the foremost trading nation. Howell examined the fort through the lens of his telescope and noted the banner of Islam flying above the tower and the serried ranks of cannon along the tops of the walls. Those weapons could hurl heated shot onto any hostile vessel that attempted to enter the bay. He felt a thrill of foreboding along his spine as he contemplated the fact that if he enlisted with the forces of the Prester, he would become the enemy of Ahmed El Grang. One day those huge cannon might be firing upon the Golden Bough. In the meantime, he must make the most of this last opportunity to enter the Omani camp as a neutral, and to gather all the intelligence that came his way. The harbour was crowded with small craft, mostly the dhows of the Mussulmen from India, Arabia, and Muscat. There were 2 tall ships amongst this multitude. One flew a Spanish flag, and the other was French, but Howell recognised neither. All these traders were drawn to Zanzibar by the riches of Africa, the gold of Sofala, the gum arabic, ivory, and the endless flood of humanity into its slave market. This was where 7,000 men, women, and children were offered for sale each season when the trade winds brought the barks in from around the Cape of Good Hope and from all the vast basin of the Indian Ocean. Hal dipped his ensign in courtesy to the fortress, then conned the Golden Bough towards the anchorage under topsails. At his order, the anchor splashed into the clear water, and the tiny sliver of canvas was whipped off her and furled by Abelly's exuberant Amadorda. Almost immediately, the ship was besieged by a fleet of little boats, sailing every conceivable commodity from fresh fruit and water to small boys. These last were ordered by their masters to bend over the thwarts, lift their robes, and display their small brown buttocks for the delectation of the seamen at the Golden Boy's rail. "Pretty jig-jig boys," the whoremasters crooned in pidgin English. "Sweet bums like ripe mangoes." "Mr. Tyler, have a boat lowered," Hal ordered. "I'm going ashore. I will take Althuda and Master Daniel with me, and 10 of your best men." They rowed across to the stone landing steps below the fortress walls, and Big Daniel went ashore first to plough open a passage through the throng of merchants, who swarmed down to the water's edge to offer their wares. On their last visit, he had escorted Sir Francis ashore, so he led the way. His seamen formed a phalanx around Hull, and they marched through the narrow streets. They passed through bazaars and crowded souks, where the merchants displayed their stocks. Traders and seamen from the other vessels in the harbour picked over the piles of elephant tusks and cakes of fragrant golden gum arabic, bunches of ostrich feathers and rhinoceros horns. They haggled over the price of the carpets from Muscat and the stoppered porcupine quills filled with grains of alluvial gold from Sofala and the rivers of the African interior. The slave masters paraded files of human beings for potential buyers to examine their teeth and palpate the muscles of the males or lift the aprons of the young females to consider their sweets. From this area of commerce, Big Daniel led them into a sector of the town where the buildings on each side of the lanes almost touched each other overhead and blocked out the light of day. The stench of human feces from the open sewers, which ran down to the harbour, almost suffocated them. Big Daniel stopped abruptly in front of an arched mahogany door, carved with intricate Islamic motifs and studded with iron spikes, and heaved on the dangling bell rope. Within minutes they heard the bolts on the far side being pulled back and the huge door creaked open. Half a dozen small brown faces peered out at them, boys and girls of mixed blood and of all ages, between 5 and 10 years.
"Welcome, welcome," they chirped in quaintly accented English. "The blessings of Allah the All-Merciful be upon you, English me lord. May all your days be golden and scented with wild jasmine."
A little girl seized Hal by the hand and led him through into the interior courtyard. A fountain tinkled in the centre of the air, was filled with the scent of frangipani and yellow tamarind flowers. A tall figure, clad in flowing white robes and gold-corded Arabian headdress, rose from the pile of silk carpets where he had been reclining.
"Indeed, I add 1,000 welcomes to those of my children, my good captain, and may Allah shower you with riches and blessings," he said in a familiar and comforting Yorkshire accent. "I watched your fine ship anchor in the bay, and I knew you would soon call upon me."
He clapped his hands, and from the back of the house emerged a line of slaves, each bearing trays that contained coloured glasses of sherbet and coconut milk and little bowls of sweetmeats and roasted nuts. The consul sent Big Daniel and his seamen through to the servants' quarters at the rear of the house. "They will give refreshment," he said. Hal cast Big Daniel a significant look, which the boatswain interpreted accurately. There would be no liquor in this Islamic household, but there would be women, and the seamen had to be protected from themselves. Hal kept Al-Thuda beside him. There might be call for him to draw up documents or to take down notes. The consul led them to a secluded corner of the courtyard. "Now, let me introduce myself. I am William Grey, His Majesty's consul to the Sultanate of Zanzibar."
"Henry Courtney at your service, sir."
"And you, Sir Francis Courtney, are you by chance related?"
"My father, sir."
"Ah, an honourable man. Please give him my respects when next you meet. Tragically, he was killed in the Dutch War." "My condolences, Sir Henry. Please be seated."
A pile of beautifully patterned silk carpets had been set close at hand for Hal. The consul sat opposite him. Once he was comfortable, a slave brought Grey a water pipe. "A pipe full of bung is a sovereign remedy for distempers of the liver and for the malaria which is a plague in these climes. Will you join me, sir?" Hal refused this offer, for he knew of the tricks the Indian hemp flowers played upon the mind, and the dreams and trances with which it could ensnare the smoker. While he puffed at his pipe, Grey questioned him cunningly as to his recent movements and his future plans. And Hal was polite but evasive. Like a pair of duelists, they sparred and waited for an opening. As the water bubbled in the tall glass bowl of the pipe and the fragrant smoke drifted across the courtyard, Grey became more affable and expansive. "You live in the style of a great sheik," Hal tried a little flattery, and Grey responded with gratification. "Would you find it difficult to believe that 15 years ago I was merely a lowly clerk in the employment of the English East India Company? When my ship was wrecked on the corals of Sofala, I came ashore here as a castaway." He shrugged and made a gesture that was more oriental than English. "As you say, Allah has smiled on me."
"You have embraced Islam?"
Hal did not allow his expression to show the repugnance he felt for the apostate.
"I am a true believer in the one God, in Mohammed and his prophet."
Grey nodded.
Hal wondered how much his decision to convert had rested on political and practical considerations. Grey, the Christian, would not have prospered in Zanzibar as Grey, the Mussulman, so obviously had.
"Most Englishmen who call at Zanzibar have one thing in mind," Grey went on. "They've come here for trade, and usually to acquire cargo of slaves. I regret that this is not the best season for slaving.
The trade winds have brought in the dhows from further India and beyond. They have already carried away the best specimens, and what is now left in the market is the dregs. However, in my own barracoon I have 200 prime creatures, the best you will find in 1,000 miles of sailing.
Thank you, sir, but I'm not interested in slaving, Howell declined.
That, sir, is a regrettable decision. I assure you there are fine and great fortunes still to be made in the trade. The Brazilians and the Caribbean sugar planters are crying out for labour to work their fields.
Thank you again. I am not in the market.
Now it was clear to Howell how Grey had made his own fortune. The post of consul was secondary to that of agent and middleman to European traders calling in at Zanzibar.
Then there is another highly profitable area in which I could be of assistance to you. Grey paused delicately.
I observed your ship from my rooftop when you anchored and could not but notice that she is well armed. One might be forgiven for believing her to be a man of war.
Howell nodded noncommittally, and Grey continued.
You may not know that the Sultan of Oman, beloved of Allah, Ahmed El Grang, is at war with the Emperor of Ethiopia.
I had heard so.
A war is raging on land and sea. The Sultan has issued letters of marque to ships who wish to join his forces. These commissions have been in the main restricted to Muslim captains. However, I have great influence at the Sultan's court. I may be able to obtain a commission for you. Of course, such a boon does not come cheaply. It would cost £200 for me to obtain an Omani letter of marque for you, sir.